Thank you so much for joining us this evening, everyone, for our Parkinson's Support Group program. For anybody who's not aware, this program is part of the OU's Spirit Initiative, and Spirit is the stimulating program initiative for retirees that inspires thought. I'm Judy Steinig, Senior Director of the OU's Department of Community Projects and Partnerships and Coordinator and Host for Spirit. This program that we're doing tonight was formed actually as a request from some of you who attended a program that we did in the middle of June on Parkinson's, which is in our archives, and you're welcome to view it at any time. And during the course of that program, which had amazing therapeutic ideas that are really groundbreaking now, during the course of that program, a few of you chatted in and said, can we form a support group? And we said, why not? Let's try it. So here we are tonight. We had one several weeks ago. And then I had the wonderful fortune to connect up with Faiga Brisbane Taylor, who will be presenting to us tonight. And we're trying to give people the information and support that they need to get through these challenging times. Now it is my pleasure and honor to turn the Spirit Forum over to Faiga Brisbane Taylor, who is the Senior Associate Director of Advancement for the Michael J. Fox Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you, Faiga, for presenting to us this evening.
Thank you so much, Robinson Steinig. It's so nice to be here. I think I was telling people before that I present so many times and I speak to so many communities, but it's not often that I get to speak to my community and share the knowledge that I've learned by working at the Michael J. Fox Foundation. Very quickly, my role at the foundation as Senior Associate Director of Advancement is to speak to donors, to community members, to groups like yours, and talk about the incredible research that's being done behind the scenes. So with that, I'm going to jump right into this presentation. All right, Robinson Steinig, let me know if people can't see the full screen or if anything's not being shared.
It looks great to me. We're good.
Perfect. Okay, great. Okay, so the mission of the Michael J. Fox Foundation is that we are dedicated to finding a cure for Parkinson's disease through an aggressively funded research agenda and to ensuring the development of improved therapies for those living with Parkinson's today. So in short, we want to find a cure. As a bit of background about the foundation, why we do what we're doing, it's because we are following our founder, the actor Michael J. Fox. He was diagnosed 23 years ago, and he wants a cure. So a lot of organizations do different things. They have social services. We really focus on these large points of our mission, which are to find a cure and to find better symptomatic treatments. For a bit about us, there are over 220 of us right now, based out of New York. We have over 125,000 supporters. We have probably about $2.5 billion worth of funded research now, which makes us far and away the largest funders of Parkinson's research in the world. We fund thousands of projects per year. We're very egalitarian with our funding. We don't let politics get in the way of our mission. And about 40% of our funding is outside of the United States because we want to fund the best work wherever it might be. If you gain money from us through our granting program, which I'll talk about in a minute, you then have signed yourself onto a transparency clause. So we have over 400 researchers a year. If they receive money from us, they then convene with other researchers. We believe in full transparency. That's the fastest way to a cure and better symptomatic treatments. And in just the last year alone, our advocacy branch had contacted lawmakers through individuals, community members like you, over 20,000 times to advocate for things like Parkinson's research, our national plan to end Parkinson's, all of which I'll talk about in a bit. Now, what makes us unique? What makes us unique is our business model. We are different than other foundations. We have no endowment. We carry over no money. We take our mission very seriously, and that is to find a cure for Parkinson's disease. We often joke that we are in business to put ourselves out of business. So our unique model means that money comes in and money goes out. The shelf life of a dollar at our foundation is just about 6 months. Our granting cycles are reviewed quarterly. So we expedite that money out to projects that we deem best as quickly as we can. And we're checking in to make sure that our grantees who have taken our money and have consigned to do specific projects are checked on very frequently to make sure that they are doing exactly what they should be doing. We decide what we're going to fund with a promising panel of 15 PhDs who are on staff, one movement disorder specialist who's on staff, and 12 business strategists. The reason we have business strategists is because sometimes I'll say, you can have the best idea in the world. You could even have cured Parkinson's disease. But if your budget's not right, if your lab is not set up correctly, then it's really not an effective use of our money because your idea is just not going to come to fruition. So we take our funding, we take our milestone-driven process very seriously. As I said, we also strongly believe in collaboration. So if you are designated as a grantee of the organization, you will not only be speaking with us during our quarterly reviews, but you will be convening with your peers at least on an annual basis and usually on a biannual basis. That's so we can make sure that your project design is on target. You know, if there's new information that will help your trial, or your lab work, bench work come to fruition more quickly, you have access to that information as quickly as possible. What I sometimes like to do as we have these discussions is just give a little bit of background about clinical drug development in general. And the reason that I do this is because so often people come to me with questions about something that they read about in the media, or, you know, there was some sort of article that came up on a Google alert that said, you know, there's been a promising cure for Parkinson's in mouse models, or, you know, something very clickbait driven. So I like to talk a little bit about the state of drug development so that you can put some of these articles and some of the information that you see in context. The way that things work is when there is an idea in the eyes of a researcher, that's something we call the discovery stage. So what does a researcher do when they have an idea, they have a hypothesis that they would like to test? Generally, what they'll do is they'll apply for initial funding, mostly from the government. Usually it's the NIH. There are a couple of other places that fund the discovery periods, but usually it's the NIH or some other branch of research in the government. And they will be given an initial amount of money, and they'll be able to do something that we call preclinical work. That's usually when they're testing their ideas on benches in labs or maybe in animals. And what they're trying to do is come up with a validation of their hypothesis, or as we call target validation. And in a dream world, what you would do is your discovery period findings would be so attractive that they would pique the interest of large pharmaceutical companies or venture capitalists, people with really deep pockets, deeper pockets than the government. And they would be enticed to follow your hypothesis through and maybe take it through clinical trials, which means testing in human beings. And the reason that they would do this is because they're driven by business, and they think that this idea is so promising that if it ends up on drug shelves, it will really help people, in our case, who are living with Parkinson's disease. Sometimes, you know, the government or whatever organization can't quite match the needs of a researcher's idea. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a great idea. Sometimes it can mean that they just need more money or they need more time, but that's just not something that's being afforded to them by the government. That's sort of what some of the PhDs that I worked with would jokingly call the graveyard for for research, because that's where good ideas would go to die. And it's not because they weren't good ideas. It's simply because they didn't have enough time and money to really tweak what they were trying to do. So very often we find that to be a good strategic place to put our money in between the discovery period, but not quite when we get to clinical trials. The reason being that we just don't have deep enough pockets to fund clinical trials. By the time something gets to a clinical trial phase, it costs about $1 billion. So we've raised incredible funds, we've dispensed incredible amounts of funds, but even $2.5 billion isn't going to get you very far when it comes to drug development. So if you see an article and talks about preclinical models, or it talks about how it's testing this wonderful new cure for Parkinson's in animals, that's really something that I would take with a grain of salt when reading those articles. However, if you're reading an article and it's talking about drug development or another idea that's in phase one, phase two, or phase three of clinical trials, that's where I would take pause and look into it, because that means that it's already being tested in humans. That means it's well on its way to perhaps one day finding itself in your medicine cabinet, which is very exciting. But even with that, just to put a little bit more of a timeline on it, because people will often ask me for a timeline, like how long is it going to take? When you're reading the articles and you see it talks about a trial or a drug that's in phase one of clinical testing, what that means is that it's being tested just to see if it's safe in humans. And that can usually take about 1 year. When something's in phase two of clinical trial testing, that means it's a little bit broader. We're trying to see if it's, you know, we know that it's safe because it passed phase one. But in phase two, we're trying to see, is it actually working to meet its target? And what are the side effects? What are some of those short-term side effects? That can take 2 to 3 years. And then phase three, which we're all hoping that the best ideas go to, is really when we expand this project so that we have a number of people involved in the clinical trial. We know it's safe, we know it's meeting its target, but is it doing what it's supposed to do? That's also where the FDA comes in. And as long as phase three goes well, that's where a drug will need FDA approval. And that's obviously what we're all hoping for. So now as we go forth and we read a lot of these articles that tout a lot of claims, you know, hopefully we'll have a little bit more information about the projects that they're talking about, and we'll be able to have a more critical eye on what may or may not be promising. All right, so that was a bit of background, a bit of context, so we're all on the same page as we go through what I sometimes refer to as the meat of this discussion, the meat of what we're here to learn about today, which is research. What are we doing? So this is a bit of an agenda for what we'll be discussing. And I've gone ahead and I've split some of our research into what I, you know, find to be the three main buckets, our three main portfolio areas of concentration. The first one is called disease modifying, and sometimes I'll call that like our cure portfolio. But essentially what we're looking for in that portfolio is what is going to change the face of the disease? What is going to change the face of Parkinson's as we know it? What is going to slow, stop progression, perhaps, please God, one day, even dial back progression? Our second bucket is something called the symptomatic portfolio. And that's really how we can improve the lives of people who are living with Parkinson's day to day. You know, what are your motor symptoms and how can we treat them? Your non-motor symptoms, there are emerging targets. We'll discuss a lot of different symptoms, or we'll take a quick look at them, and we'll see what that research landscape looks like. And then the third portfolio area that we'll take a quick look at today is something I call field-wide challenges. And that's really a question of why haven't we met these first two targets? You know, what is keeping us from finding a cure? You know, what is keeping us from finding a particular treatment for a symptom? And how can we take those roadblocks and move them out of the way in order to expedite our mission? Okay. Are we saving all questions for the end, Robinson-Steiner, or should I take a breather for a minute?
I'd say whatever you're comfortable with. I don't have any questions here yet. If you have any, you can look. But Anything I have, I think I'm going to hold on to until you let me know. Okay. But there's nothing in my chat now.
All right, perfect. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to go through the first portfolio, and I'll stop after each one of these three and we'll see if we have specific questions that pertain to those, and then we'll move on. Okay, so with that, let's talk about disease modification. As I mentioned, what that means is, what are we doing to stop Parkinson's? What are we doing to slow the progression of Parkinson's? What are we doing to prevent Parkinson's? And you know, what perhaps can we look forward to when we talk about dialing back the clock in terms of symptoms? Okay. So sometimes I like to make this a little interactive, but I can't really see everybody. So here, let's see if I can get a couple more people in my view. The first target that is deemed one of the most promising targets is something called alpha-synuclein. By raise of hands, has anybody heard of this term alpha-synuclein before? Okay, don't really see a lot of hands raised, so I'm going to assume that it's a new term for most. It's closely related to another term I think you might know, dopamine. Anybody heard of dopamine? All right, I'm seeing some nodding heads. I'm seeing some raised hands. That's great. So we know that Parkinson's is caused by a depletion of dopamine in the brain, or compromised dopamine in the brain. But why? What has happened to the dopamine to compromise it? Why isn't dopamine and people with Parkinson's working the way that it does in the general population? Well, we have identified what we believe is the main culprit of dopamine depletion, dopamine loss, or dopamine just not working as it usually does. And that is a protein called alpha-synuclein. What alpha-synuclein is, it's a protein that's present in everybody's body, people with Parkinson's, people without. But we have found that by and large, in people with Parkinson's, it doesn't act the same way that it does in the general population. It's instead of passing through the cell the way that other proteins do, it clumps up. Sometimes I'll liken it to maybe like a jammed printer, you know, a working printer. Those sheets of paper, they sort of slide right through. But in Parkinson's, what happens is, as that sheet of paper, or in this case, your alpha-synuclein protein is sliding through the cell, it sort of clumps up and it's not passing through appropriately. We believe that those clumps then form these aggregations that creates a toxic environment for dopamine. So that is one area that we find very promising. You know, we're talking about dopamine, but let's try and make sure our dopamine's not at risk in the first place. Let's create an environment in the brain where dopamine can thrive. So alpha-synuclein is a very promising target in that way, because we're hoping to get a step ahead of that dopamine loss. Another very promising area that we've been exploring are genetic targets. Sometimes I'll talk about these. The unfortunate fact of the matter is that a lot of the genetic links to Parkinson's disease are carried by Ashkenazi Jews. The main links, genetic mutations that we know are associated with an onset of Parkinson's disease, are GBA and LRRK2, both of which are prominent in the Ashkenazi Jewish communities as well as others. I will say, and something that I do like to make very clear, is carriers of these genetic mutations are not sentenced to an onset of Parkinson's at some time in their life. What carrying this genetic mutation means is that you perhaps have a higher risk of getting Parkinson's at some point, as opposed to people who don't have this genetic mutation. So again, it means you have a higher likelihood, and even in, you know, the highest likelihood with any of these genetic mutations, or maybe you're 30% more likely than someone without them to develop Parkinson's at some time in your life. So certainly a bit of a greater risk, but just very often when people have these genetic mutations, they sort of feel like, you know, they might be carrying some sort of life sentence, or they might be, you know, deeming their family members to some sort of life sentence. It's not that way at all. You know, the risk is possibly higher, or the risk is definitely higher, but by all means, it's not a certainty. That's, again, another very promising target for taking a look at Parkinson's and trying to change the way. I always get distracted by questions, but I think a recording will be sent out. But back to genetic targets, we are setting genetic targets, and I'll discuss why in a little bit. And then we also have been taking, especially in recent years, a very close look at the underlying biology and cellular processes. You know, as much as we know, there's so much we don't know. So one of the biggest donors to the Michael J. Fox Foundation, whose mother has Parkinson's, and he himself is a carrier of one of these genetic links that we've discussed, formed something called ASAP, which is Aligned Sciences Around Parkinson's. And what that is we are taking all different sciences and we are looking for ways that we can use them to really find out more about the basic biology, the basic cellular structures, find more promising treatment targets, because we know a lot, but there's always more that we can know. So these are some of the different targets that we have that we're working on to slow or stop progression. Okay, so I just wanted to review some of these approaches to alpha-synuclein that we currently are working on. We have 13 different clinical trials that are currently exploring alpha-synuclein aggregation and how we can treat it, how we can do any number of things, which I'll discuss now. And something that I like to point out is not all of these clinical trials are doing the same thing. You know, we have multiple shots on goal. We are looking at multiple different ways that we can solve this problem of alpha-synuclein accumulation. The first one that we see here is something called clearance. It currently is in clinical trials, which means that we are currently testing in humans how we can clear out alpha-synuclein by ramping up the body's garbage disposal system. You know, we learn about like some of the parts of the cell when we're in grade school, but this is really where it comes into play. Like, do we remember what the lysosomes are, the garbage disposal system? Like, that's really imperative, we believe, in the function of alpha-synuclein and perhaps clearing those aggregations. We have immunotherapy approaches. Immunotherapy is something we're all very familiar with as we leave the age of COVID. Also, it is currently in clinical trials being tested on humans. Can we create an antibody that will trick the body into clearing out these misfolded proteins on our own, sort of using our body's own systems to prompt ourselves into having alpha-synuclein work the way that it does in the general population? And then the third approach is something called disaggregation. You know, can we create something that would prevent alpha-synuclein from folding in the first place? You know, perhaps we could stop dopamine loss where it is and just maintain status quo. So there's quite a lot that we could do with that. In the preclinical stage, even though it's at the top, we do have this translation model that we are hoping to test at some point in humans. And what we're doing with that is we're trying to find different ways to trick the body into just making less alpha-synuclein, so it becomes less of an issue or less of a problem. Now, going back to our genetic discoveries that can point to widespread treatments, a question that I get asked often is this. If you look at the statistics of people who have a genetic link to Parkinson's, it's only about 10% of all people with Parkinson's. It's not very high, or at least known genetic links right now. Most people have something that we call idiopathic Parkinson's, which means we're not quite sure why they have Parkinson's. So a lot of people ask me, why does the foundation, why does the research world in general spend so much time studying genetics if most people who have Parkinson's don't have a genetic link? And the reason is because what genetics are they're like a recipe. They're like a recipe card. And when you're following a recipe, or say when you're making a cake, if your cake doesn't turn out right, you go back to the recipe and you're like, ooh, put in a little too much flour. Ooh, I forgot the eggs. It's the same in Parkinson's. When there's a genetic mutation and we look at the DNA, we look at the DNA like a recipe. You know, which of these mutations is something that's dialed up a little bit too much? Or which of these mutations something that's dialed back a little bit? That can give us an insight into what all people with Parkinson's might have dialed up a little too much, or, you know, dialed down a little bit too much. So it's just a wonderful way to sort of have a shortcut into what might be going on with everyone with Parkinson's. And sometimes I like to illustrate how very important looking at genetics is by talking about how we discovered alpha-synuclein. Alpha-synuclein is like a rather new discovery. We know it's a protein, but we don't actually know what its function is. The only reason that we even discovered alpha-synuclein and it's linked to Parkinson's is because there was one family that lived in Europe, and almost every single member of that family would go on to develop Parkinson's in their life. And that was a phenomenon that was not seen anywhere else. So we decided to study that family, and we took DNA from them. And alpha-synuclein is a protein, but it also does express itself as a gene. And we found that they all had a mutation on their alpha-synuclein gene. And we were able to use that information to look at the general population and realize alpha-synuclein in people who don't have that gene but do have Parkinson's is still an issue. So when we look at genetic mutations, it really provides us with an insight into all people with Parkinson's. It's sort of like a shortcut. So sometimes I like to discuss how that therapy helps the wider population of people with Parkinson's. Okay, before I move on to symptomatic treatments, I saw I got a couple of questions. So one of them is, aren't only about 10% of cases from genetics? Yes, that would be accurate. And what year was alpha-synuclein discovered? It was discovered in the 1990s. I'm going to say 96, but the truth is, I am not sure. I'm not positive. We can look that up if you'd like to know.
I have one question here also.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, the same too you did. But okay, somebody would like you to address, maybe this will come on later, vitamin B1 and Parkinson. Is that something for later on?
I'm not actually going to address that later on, but it would be part of the symptomatic portfolio. I will say that vitamins in general are something that you should ask your doctor about. I know a lot about Parkinson's. I study it a lot. I'm not a medical doctor. For the most part, there have been a lot of research that has studied the effects of different vitamins. None of it has been conclusive. So I can say from a research standpoint, I really can't vouch for not just B1, but like a lot of people talk about CoQ10, a lot of different things. You know, I meet people who take vitamins and they feel better. As long as you speak to your doctor about whether or not there's something that could interfere with your medication regimen, I would just make sure you have a good care team that you trust. And all I can share is that I really can say from a clinical perspective, I have not seen any trials that would back up a specific vitamin regimen in addition to your general medications. Okay. Are we ready for the symptomatic portfolio?
Yeah, I don't have anything else.
All right, perfect. So the symptomatic portfolio is, again, where we explore the different symptoms of Parkinson's disease. You know, what can we do to make the lives of people with Parkinson's more comfortable right now? Okay. Very often, the main symptom that's associated with Parkinson's is tremor. But all of us who have loved ones or know people or have Parkinson's know that that is really just the tipping point. And I know so many with people with Parkinson's that actually don't have tremor at all. So this is just a little chart to, you know, point out the different symptoms that are associated with Parkinson's. Some of them are motor symptoms. You know, even if you don't have tremor, some people have stiffness. Some of them are non-motor symptoms. People can have sleep issues, or people can have digestion issues. That's one that I really hear a lot. There are certain things like sleep, smell, and digestion issues that very often people will tell me they experienced years before they had their diagnosis. So we know that there are a lot of symptoms that really need to be treated individually. So even if you're on a medication regimen for Parkinson's, making sure that you pay attention to what your symptoms are is really going to be key to living your best possible life with these symptoms. So why, before we talked about drug development, and I just wanted to give a pictorial of all of the different recent approvals, drug approvals for Parkinson's. You know, there is still a gold standard of medication that's called Sinemet, or it's called levodopa carbidopa, or whatever. You know, you might be taking a dopamine agonist, whatever it might be. The gold standard has not changed for 50 years. What we need when we have Parkinson's and we have dopamine replacement, we need to replace that dopamine. And that's the most effective way to do it. Is with levodopa. Carbidopa really helps that medication cross the blood-brain barrier with less side effects. But there have been so many different drug approvals in the last few years. If you look at this chart, there have been 17 in the last few years alone. And the Michael J. Fox Foundation has had a big hand in many of these, if not all of them. What I see as a big concentration right now is not the chemistry of the medication. It's not the levodopa carbidopa, but it's the formulation of the medication. We know that the chemistry is correct. We know that that is what replaces dopamine in your brain, but how it gets to its target, how it gets to that substantia nigra in the middle of your brain could really be variable. You know, we discussed digestion issues in people with Parkinson's. So sometimes for many people, taking a pill, having it maybe interact with what you've eaten or drank that day, with your metabolism, waiting for it to break down, coming, you know, traveling back up, crossing the blood-brain barrier, getting to where it needs to be, you know, it might not be as effective, or as your, you know, symptoms progress, it might not work the way that it used to. So what we've been seeing are a lot of different formulations coming on the market. We've been seeing inhaled forms of levodopa carbidopa. We've been seeing pump forms, patch forms. In addition to that, we've been seeing deep brain stimulation. There have been new forms of it that have been, we've just perfected it more and more. There are different apps or handheld devices or ways that you can program it in a way that you couldn't in the past. For those of you who don't know, deep brain stimulation is, of course, a surgery where you have electrodes that are implanted in the brain and sort of are programmed to go off at certain intervals, which seem to help with motor symptoms. But I just wanted to give you a pictorial of, we're living with Parkinson's. There are so many options. Many people don't even know the options that are available to them. But now more than ever, you know, being treated for Parkinson's and having, you know, all sorts of wonderful tools in your toolkit to use to treat your symptoms are available. So I do encourage you to look into all of these different medications that are available and make sure that you are taking what's right for you. What else can help us manage our symptoms? As you see, I am a believer in taking medications and the right medications for you. But we also know that a lot of living with Parkinson's is behavior modification and is lifestyle. Now, when I talk about this, I will bring the caveat that the evidence towards exercise, diet, self-care, this is all anecdotal evidence. These aren't things that we can test in a lab. We can't have a clinical trial, you know, where we have one person as a couch potato and one person running every day and, you know, comparing whether or not their symptoms are okay. We know because by and large, people who exercise do better. people who are mindful of their diet. And very often people ask me which diet is the best for them. We have a diet guide, which I'm happy to distribute for anyone who is interested. We know that there are certain diets that make people feel better, and there are certain diets that don't seem to be helping symptoms. Especially today, I'm just so happy to see so many people have turned up here and are looking for support and looking for information, because we know that self-care can really alleviate stress. Stress is a huge cause of symptom flare-up. So making sure that you are doing everything within your power to create a lifestyle that is less stressful. And sometimes exercise can help with that. But just getting involved with community is really key. Very often people with Parkinson's, they draw in physically, emotionally. And we just know that people who turn out, who are big, I'm sure some of you get that therapy reference, do better. Then, of course, what I will often talk about is building a care team. Living well with Parkinson's is behavior modification, but it's also making sure that you treat things symptom by symptom. There's not a magic bullet cure for a myriad of symptoms that come along with this diagnosis. So if you need a speech therapist, there are Parkinson's specific speech therapists. If you go to a neurologist, there are movement disorder specialists. And, you know, just making sure that you have the best, most specialized care for you. People who are familiar with the fact that, you know, Parkinson's is not the same sort of modality in terms of therapies that a number of other diagnoses might bring. So making sure that you build the best possible care team for you. Okay, any questions on that? I think I have one. Okay, I do have one question. It says, why is the older CL used as the main focus with its highs and lows when there are other options? I'm not sure what CL means. Sherry, if you can just message me really quick, that would be great. Representative Steinig, in the meantime, do you have any questions?
One second. I think CL is Carbelieve.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to check my email right now. Yeah, I'm not sure about that. Please feel free to send me an email and I will look into that question for you.
Okay. There's one other, not a comment, a question, but actually a comment. Somebody wants to respond about the idea of being interested in diet information. Do you have anything that you can give us that we can send out with the recording?
Yeah, I absolutely have a diet guide. I'll give you a little spoiler. It seems like the most, and again, this is all observational, circumstantial, anecdotal evidence, seems to say that the MIND diet or the Mediterranean diet work very well to prevent neurodegeneration.
So that question about the CL.
Yeah.
So wait, the person got back on. Carbelieva.
Yeah. Okay. So now I get it. Sorry. I actually call it L-DOPA. So carbidopa, levodopa. So yes. So that drug that I was mentioning with the highs and the lows, what we're trying to do always is the highs and the lows are variable because of the individuals taking them. So that's why there are so many different formulations of it. And a lot of the newer formulations are things that would sort of like, you would take them in conjunction with your regular carbidopa levodopa, because it would prevent it from breaking down as quickly, or it would make it more long lasting, or it would do what we call these, we would try to get it slow and steady. What's happening, you know, when I talked about digestion interference or whatever it would be, what's happening is we have something called on and off periods when your medication is not getting to where it needs to be in enough time, or we have something called dyskinesia, which means you're getting too much medication too quickly and it's resulting in movements. They're different than your regular tremor. Usually the movements are more rounded. That means you're getting too much medication too quickly, and then something called off periods or freezing periods, freezing of the gait, is when you're not getting enough medication when you should. And some people freeze or pause. So a couple of these new formulations are something called rescue therapies, which means you wouldn't take them every day. It'd be something like Inbrija, you would keep it in your pocket. And if you felt an off period coming on, you would then, Inbrija is an inhaled form. So you just take a puff and that medication, instead of going through your digestive system, it would absorb through the membranes in your cheek and it would kick in about 10 minutes. With all of these new formulations, what we're looking for is what will make the medication in this individual with Parkinson's have a slow and steady dosage throughout the day. What will make sure that the medication doesn't either break down too quickly or too slowly? Unfortunately, a lot of the onus is on people with Parkinson's also to make sure that they're keeping track of patterns in their medication. So they know, like, you know what? The medication's wearing off during this time of day. Maybe I need to speak to my doctor about either readjusting my dosage or taking it at a different period of time or whatever it might be. So all of these new formulations, again, it's not really the chemistry. People do use the older ones because they work, because they're really great. And you know, these new formulations, they're sort of like the new kid on the block. I myself know a lot of people who have taken some of the new formulations, some okay, some not. But when it comes to drug management, it's always just like this little dance to make sure that it's perfect. So if the tried and true is going to work for you, that's where your doctor's generally going to go first. But knowing if it doesn't, or if you'd like to try something else, what your options are and bringing those to your movement disorder specialist, I think is really important. So just having the education of looking into these things, knowing that they exist, keeping track of, you know, how your medication is working for you is really just so important. You know, everyone who has a doctor has to advocate for themselves. And in this case, I would say that it's sort of like that. So the older formulations are tried and true. They will be used more. And the newer medications, you're right, they're sort of like a fallback, but some of them are very effective. And I'm sure that if you read up on one and you think it might be a good use for you, or it might be something that you would want to try, I would definitely bring that suggestion to your movement disorder specialist. So I think the first step is just knowing it exists and knowing that you have options. But I do agree with you. A lot of doctors like the tried and true because they know that it's effective. So yeah, hopefully that answered that question. Okay, anything else? Field-wide challenges. Okay.
Nothing on my end.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. So field-wide challenges, again, this portfolio is really dedicated to what might be some roadblocks. Like, why don't we have a cure yet? You know, why don't we have better treatment options for certain symptoms? You know, what's keeping us from these lofty goals that I've mentioned in our mission? All right. Our first roadblock that I talk about quite a bit, and I'm actually very excited to talk about today, is the fact that there has not been something called a biomarker. A biomarker is a diagnostic tool for Parkinson's. So often when I speak to people with Parkinson's, they have a story about their diagnosis. They went to the doctor and they weren't sure. They had this symptom. They were sent to that neurologist. Or some people will say to me, you know, I was given this diagnosis, my life has changed, but you know, it just didn't feel very scientific. How could I get this diagnosis from a man who had me walk up and down a hall, had me go like this a few times, and then he's going to tell me something that's going to change the course of my life? And the reason that people are having these experiences is because of the lack of something called a biomarker. An example of a biomarker would be like testing your blood sugar for diabetes. There's a definitive test. It can tell you where your blood sugar is and whether or not you have diabetes. There's nothing like that for Parkinson's. There's no one conclusive test that you could take that says, yes, you have Parkinson's, no, you have Parkinson's. A diagnosis is usually made by a neurologist or movement disorder specialist who uses a number of very clarifying clues or just their general experience or something called a UPDRS score, and then gives you a diagnosis based on that. So our search for a biomarker is not only important towards a diagnosis, but with Parkinson's having actually a rather high rate of misdiagnosis, what would happen if we have a number of people who are misdiagnosed with Parkinson's, and then they're enrolled in some of these clinical trials that I told you about, but they don't have Parkinson's, and that clinical trial is not successful because it's not being tested on the right population? Well, what happens when we have a clinical trial and it is being tested on the right population, but we don't have a definitive test that can measure whether or not someone's getting better? Say you're part of a clinical trial to clear up alpha-synuclein aggregation. Well, until recently, alpha-synuclein was never seen in the living brain. We only knew its existence because of autopsy tissue. So how are we going to measure definitively whether or not someone's getting better with the treatment? The unfortunate fact of the matter is people with Parkinson's have compromised dopamine, which means that they're highly susceptible to placebo effect. There's just so many roadblocks that are involved with not having a proper biomarker. So again, early diagnosis and therapeutic intervention, a biomarker could help with that. It would help chart with your disease progression. We'd be able to see definitively if we had a measurement, are you getting better on this treatment? Are you staying the same? Or have you progressed? It would help us design clinical trials. We'd be able to get through clinical trials a lot more quickly because we'd be able to test in real time whether or not somebody is getting better, rather than just have to rely on asking them, do you feel better after this treatment? Do you feel better in this clinical trial? We could test the impact of new therapies more quickly. We'd be able to see if people were suffering aggregation, maybe before symptoms came. We'd be able to look at early intervention in a new way to help try and stop symptoms before they started. And we could even get to a point where maybe we could prevent Parkinson's from starting in someone who maybe seemed to test on a biomarker as being at risk for having Parkinson's. So what we've done for this field-wide challenge is we created something called the Parkinson's Progressions Markers Initiative. This is one of the only clinical trials that we do in-house. We administer it at the foundation. Generally, we have grantees, so we're paying other people, giving them the money to do the work themselves. But we actually administer the Parkinson's Progressions Markers Initiative. It is a clinical trial, but it's not a clinical trial in the way that we're used to. It's an observational study, which means that if you sign up for this clinical trial, you sign up for 5 years of being observed in any number of ways. You're giving fluid samples, skin samples, all sorts of tissue samples. Some are very invasive, including cerebral spinal fluid. So you're subjecting yourselves to a spinal tap. It was launched in 2010. We have over 4,000 participants. It is international because we are looking for any way to measure Parkinson's worldwide. So we are looking for any number of ways that we can observe physically or otherwise people with Parkinson's and see what is measurable. What can we apply to everyone so that we can test it and finally have this very conclusive diagnostic tool for Parkinson's? Again, as I mentioned, all of these data sets are readily available. If you are getting money from the Michael J. Fox Foundation, there needs to be transparency. So this data is readily available on any website. You probably access it if you wanted to. But all of the data that we have observed in the past 13 years has been downloaded over 8.5 million times. And sometimes just like thinking about that number gives me chills, because there could be someone that is working on a cure right now using these data sets. And You know, we don't even know it, but that is a lot of times a lot of information, and it is by far the largest data set of people with Parkinson's in the entire world. You can also request tissue samples for your research as well. So this biorepository and repository of information is really crucial to finding a conclusive biomarker for Parkinson's disease. And with that, I am so excited to announce, and you may have seen in the news, we actually did finally find a biomarker for Parkinson's disease. It was announced this past April, and it's something called an alpha-synuclein seeding amplification assay. And what this is basically, for the first time, we are able to test for alpha-synuclein in living tissue. The process of this is a little bit unfortunate. We were able to find these alpha-synuclein aggregates in cerebral spinal fluid. So it is a very invasive test for this biomarker. So what we are trying to do right now within the foundation is take the chemistry of this test, which we know works. We know that we're able to see alpha-synuclein aggregates in real time. We can see if you have more, possibly see if you have less, but right now we're just looking at it as like a more definitive diagnostic tool. And we're trying to make it a little bit more palatable for the general public. So it could be something that is really like used at your doctor's office. So it would be, we're hoping to change it into something like a blood test or a nasal swab or something that could really be like readily available and not as invasive as a spinal tap. But, you know, it would just take clinical trials and it would take the drug development and it would take our search for a cure and it would speed it ahead by about 6 years, which is incredible to think. Like there are things that are currently in clinical trials right now that could cure Parkinson's disease. It's just so long and slow because we don't have a definitive biomarker. We at the foundation are really hoping once we perfect this, that we can change that. And the seeding amplification assay is actually already being used in clinical trials right now. So we're very excited to see how this affects the progress and the speed of research. Okay, looks like I have a couple of questions. Okay. So yes, there is a skin alpha-synuclein test that's offered from a firm in Boston. And yes, it is legit. It is possible. It's not a seeding amplification assay the way that ours is. And ours is like a little bit more Parkinson's specific. That alpha-synuclein skin biopsy test that you're referring to from a firm out in Boston, that basically tells you if you have a synucleinopathy. And Parkinson's is not the only neurodegenerative disease that has synucleinopathy. So when they test you, you could have Parkinson's, you could have something called MSA, you could have Lewy body dementia. You know, there's a number of different diagnoses. Our test is more Parkinson's specific, but again, alpha-synuclein aggregates are, you know, something that affects a number of people with other diagnoses beyond Parkinson's disease. And then did I address freezing? It comes on without warning and it's caused, yeah, falls with significant injuries. The falls feel similar to a large piece of wood falling flat. I'm so sorry to hear that, Cheryl. So I can address freezing and I'm happy to do that. Freezing again is really a good indication that your medication is not getting to where it needs to be in the time that it needs to be. It means that it's wearing off a little bit too quickly. So again, I'll refer you and I'm happy to give out the slide with different drugs, with those different drugs, that have been approved on them. But if you're suffering from freezing of gait, that generally means that you will need to adjust your medication. That's something you would need to do with your movement disorder specialist. And on the Michael J. Fox Foundation website, there's actually a tab that I believe is called like drugs and treatments. And that also has like a very significant list of all of these drugs and actually has more information about when they're used and how they're used. So please try and remind me or email me to send you a link to that as well. But freezing is an immediate safety risk. It's an immediate safety concern. I know that there are a number of technological gadgets that have come out to help people who experience freezing. So those might be something that you want to explore as well. I don't have any specific suggestions about them. Gadgets and FDA approval or tech and FDA approval is iffy, but I can definitely point you in the direction on our website to different things that might help you with this immediate safety risk. But I also really encourage people who experience freezing or experience these off periods to revisit their medication management. They might do well with another formulation or with exploring different timing of the medications because it's just not working well enough for you. So again, it's probably not the chemistry of what you're taking, but the methodology could be perfected. Okay. Robertson-Steinig, do you have any questions?
No, I don't have anything else here.
Okay. Well, with that, I feel like I've spoken a lot. So I'll just end off quickly with what can you do today? You know, you've shown up today, which is like such a wonderful first step. But I always like to arm people with what they can do. You know, this diagnosis can really leave people feeling like they don't have a lot of control. But here are some suggestions. You can participate in research. I mentioned a number of clinical trials. Here are a couple of clinical trials that are very easy for you to do from the comfort of your own home. There's a PPMI online, so that clinical trial that I spoke about before, we'll get to it again. You can do an online version, or you can see if there's a PPMI site near you, and you can just go on the PPMI website and look for that. You can also join Fox Insight. Fox Insight is entirely online. You fill out some surveys quarterly, and you help research. It also is great for you because you get to actually view your results. So sometimes it's interesting to look back and see how you were feeling 3 months ago or 6 months ago or 9 months ago. And I know some people who even print out the results of their Fox Insight studies and bring it to the doctor with them because it sort of helps them track their progression. If you're interested in participating in other clinical trials, we have something called Fox Trial Finder. And sometimes I'll refer to that as the match.com of clinical trials, but you go on, you fill out a little information about yourself, and it tells you what clinical trials you qualify for in your area. So that might be great for anyone who wants to be involved in research. There are different ways you can get involved at the Michael J. Fox Foundation. Beyond those clinical trials that I just discussed, we have webinars and podcasts. Tons of information. Our in-house movement disorder specialist, Dr. Rachel Dolan, has this wonderful Ask the MD column with videos, and she really touches on anything and everything in terms of Parkinson's symptoms. If there's something you don't see there, which I'd be surprised about, let me know. She would love suggestions about what she can talk about next. We have something called the Parkinson's Buddy Network. That's an online social networking tool. You can go on and be a mentor, be a mentee. You can share your experiences and learn about others' experiences. You can join Team Fox, do some grassroots fundraising. People have events or participate in all sorts of sporting events. You can advocate. We, you know, have advocated so much. I'll talk about the National Plan to End Parkinson's in a minute. And of course, you can support research with a donation of your own. Joining our community. Again, these webinars and podcasts, sorry about that. And when I talk about advocacy, I do want to make this one last final plug for the National Plan to End Parkinson's Act. There is this web address at the bottom. Please sign up. We are working to bring all federal agencies together to work on Parkinson's research. We have people who help us advocate. That can be you. We require regular reporting and accountability to Congress and the public on our progress and impact. Parkinson's is wildly underfunded, and it is the fastest growing neurodegenerative disease in the world today. So anything you can do on a personal level, governmental level, I know that a lot of you are dealing with enough, but just wanted to give you some ideas for next steps. Okay. Whew. Revidson Steinig, is there anything I'm missing?
I think that was amazing. You gave us such important information. For those who had questioned, initially we weren't planning to record this, but as you can see, it is being recorded. Everybody who is with us tonight and everybody who couldn't be with us, if anybody who registered, I hope by tomorrow, give me a little tomorrow to get the recording out. Then we will, it takes us a couple of weeks to archive it on our website. But this is information we want everybody to be able to access. In addition, we are in the process, I'm happy to tell you, on the Spirit website, that is ou.org/spirit. Right now, at this moment, is that original program I had told you about, I think it was called Think Big for Parkinson's. That's already been archived, but we are planning, I'm working with our web department to create a resource section so that all of the links that that you were giving us tonight, we will be able to put on. So many people from around the world, different organizations have already been in touch with me. It's just beautiful, the way this community is just creating itself. And when anybody has a resource to give us, our plan is to put it up so that people will be able to find it there. So that's another thing happening. And the third, wait, somebody chatted in. Oh, okay. So the your email address and the website will go. That will just send right away with the recording tomorrow. So you know, if anyone doesn't get it from the chat, don't worry about it. We will send that out right away. And the other thing I want to point out is that with God's help after Yontif, we would like to start actual small groups that we would designate those who are care partners and those who are people with Parkinson's. So you're going to be hearing about that later on. If that's something that you think you would want to be part of, small groups, we are looking for people to help us facilitate them so that it can be a very meaningful and supportive group. So that these are things that are all happening. If people have suggestions, I can't say that we can necessarily do everything that you suggest, but we are certainly happy to hear suggestions and feedback. So I want to thank Vega Brisbane Taylor for such a wonderful presentation. I want to thank all of you for joining us, and we look forward to hearing from you with your comments. I hope to get a survey out. Might not be till after yet. Okay. About your interest in the future, in being part of small groups. If that's something you think will work for you, we're happy to try to accommodate it. If it's not, if you might be part of other groups, in which case, if that's working for you, stay with that. And we will be looking for other presentations like we had tonight with other experts in this field. So thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Wishing you all a good evening. Good week, and Sima Tova. I mean, can you believe it? Not if it's right around the corner. So everybody should be well, and we look forward to greeting you again. Take care.
Thank you so much for having me. Kasiva v'chasima tova.